Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The first question I wish to address today in this case is whether a trial judge exceeds his authority when faced with an overwhelming evidentiary showing that a lawyer cannot competently or efficiently or effectively, represent a man whose liberty is at stake. And that trial judge nonetheless orders that lawyer to represent that man in violation of a duly promulgated rule which has a presumption of validity, and in violation of the rules of professional conduct in the constitutions of this nation and this state. And the answer to that question, I submit, is that no judge may ever order a lawyer, in this case, the public defender, to violate his or her solemn oath taken upon admission to the bar to obey duly promulgated rules, to abide by the rules of professional conduct, and to support the Constitution of the United States and the state of Missouri. And when a judge enters such an order, he exceeds his authority, and his appointment of that lawyer is unlawful, and a writ of prohibition must issue from this court to enjoin that unlawful act. In District 31 and seven other defender districts, notices of limit availability have been presented to the courts, and today, as we sit here in this courtroom, trial judges in those eight districts are ordering lawyers, public defenders in this case, to violate these sacred obligations. This practice must end, and it must end here today with a strong, clear, and unambiguous direction from this court, acting pursuant to the solemn responsibility that the people of Missouri have placed in your hands under Article 5, Section 4 of the Missouri Constitution, the responsibility for superintending control of the criminal justice system in this state. The implicit lesson of Pratt, and we have some dispute in the briefs about whether Pratt is a holding or a directive or a dicta, whatever. I don't want to get involved in that dispute today.
You're not going to explain Pratt to us?
I'm going to try my best, Your Honor. The implicit lesson of that case is that an overloaded public defender system may, and indeed must, limit its caseload in order to provide competent and effective assistance to its clients. And for good and powerful reasons, the Constitution and the Code of Professional Conduct cannot compel, do compel that conclusion, and the public defender statute allows it. Our Constitution is not a constitution of convenience, and because Pratt is simply not enough, we need a clear, unambiguous, strong direction, holding, ruling from this court today to the trial judges in this state that such an order appointing a lawyer under those circumstances exceeds their authority. And in that circumstance, a writ of prohibition.
Now, in Pratt, I believe Judge Wolf said the judge could not appoint the individual public defender as opposed to the public defender as the organization.
I believe, Your Honor, that it extends to, under the rule, that it extends to that office, which is placed on limited.
But I mean, specifically in Pratt, I think the judge said, under my supervisory capacity, I could appoint the public defender as a lawyer to do the case. And I think Judge Wolf said, no, you can't. And that specific individual lawyer but then there was a silence.
One of the three cases said you can't appoint a public defender in their private capacity, but the other two are what you're referring to.
Right. The three cases before, which apparently are clearly holdings of that case, that's correct. But in the portion of that case that I'm concerned with, the proper remedy under the rule, that order would pertain to the office of that public defender, right, where the public defender has exercised her professional judgment. And as a part of that exercise of professional judgment, that public defender has utilized the protocol, which plays an important but not exclusive or automatic role.
Aren't there two separate questions here? One is, does the, and there may be many, but at least two. One is, does the Public Defender's Commission have the authority to set a rule? And then if so, opposing counsel argues and that they can set rules, but not if they, those rules can be applied in a way that limits them from taking cases that the statutes require them to take. In other words, here they can set rules generally, but they say this conflicts with the statute, which requires them to take certain kinds of cases. And how we interplay that with the conflict with the constitutional obligation of all attorneys to ethically and competently represent their clients. The second issue is whether this particular protocol and this particular rule is good, and how does an individual judge determine that, or how do you challenge it if you believe that while the Public Defender Commission has the authority to set rules regarding how you limit what cases you take, this may or may not be a good rule?
This may or not be
May not be a properly established, or this may have been set at the wrong level, or they may be wrong in saying they went over. You're saying the trial court has no authority to appoint someone after the Public Defender Commission has said, no, we're over our limit. Does that mean that, how would then you contest the application of an appropriate rule in a particular case? Can't the judge say, no, I think you misapplied it, no, you're not really that busy, or are you saying that some other, what is the format? If we adopted your interpretation, would there be no room for trial judges in an individual case to challenge how the rule is applied?
Well, the issue in this case is that the public defender has said this office is on limited availability. We are overloaded, okay?
Generally, the first question is, can they do that? And the second is, did they properly do that here?
Right, okay. The answer to the first question is that they can do that because the statute must be read, we submit, to preserve its constitutionality. The statute says shall. Our argument is that the statute must be read to mean shall provide legal services, except where to do so would violate the Code of Professional Conduct, would violate the United States and Missouri constitutions. And so therefore it is a validly promulgated rule, and the rule thus understood is not in conflict with the statute.
But we have stricken down one of the previous rules promulgated by the Public Defender Commission in Pratt, the rule that invalidated someone being eligible for representation if they had had private counsel previously. So, you know, they can and have.
Absolutely. And
so
we take no
issue.
How do
we know this one isn't, this one is any two?
We take no issue with that ruling.
Okay.
That's the correct ruling.
Right.
In our
so
view.
How do we know that then this rule that we're looking at today wasn't also improper?
The claim of the respondents is that the rule is improper because it conflicts with the statute. The statute says shall.
But also beyond their authority to do so.
I don't think there's any claim that it's beyond their authority that I'm aware of. I think that this is for purposes of this case, this is a duly enacted rule, duly promulgated, entitled to a presumption of validity. I don't think there's any claim in this case.
So would you be comfortable with it if we said, and the statute says they shall be represented, except where there's a constitutional protection, and if there is so, then your rules are absolute. Then you won't have any more of these cases. If your rules are absolute, you're following the regulations, we wouldn't be coming here with different interpretations of different rules if you're protecting protecting the defendants and protecting the lawyer's ethical duties, then your rules should be absolute and not challenged.
Well, I'm comfortable with the word absolute, Your Honor.
Jose, that's not challenged.
Well, the American Bar Association is here. They're rarely in a state Supreme Court. They're almost always reserved their efforts for the United States Supreme Court. As you know, guidelines, the eight guidelines provide.
We're looking at the I have a great respect for the American Bar Association and the lawyers that serve our profession. We're looking at this statute now and trying to figure out what we should be doing. Since we had the ABA's opinion is very well taken and very well received by us. But what should we do? What kind of rules should we apply here?
I'm going to go to the second question that Judge Stiff has raised, and you've raised it too, Mr. Chief Justice. And that is that substantial deference should be given to the exercise of professional judgment by the public defender because of the unique position that that public defender is in, and particularly this public defender.
So what's the standard? Abuse of discretion? Do we have any ability to review it, or should we review it, or should the trial judges review it at all? Should someone bring a writ, or not at all? Substantial discretion, what does that mean as far as the standard of review, if any?
It means that substantial deference should be given to the exercise of professional judgment by the public defender, particularly a public defender such as this one, whose management team has 150 years collectively of experience, public defender experience. Does it mean there is no review? It does not mean there is no review.
What should that review be? What should be the standard review?
Is it like agency review where you defer to the agency's
interpretation
of its own?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me ask you a question in that regard. Oftentimes when we look at the rules of professional responsibility up against the constitutional guarantee of effective assistance of counsel, and as I understand, one of the arguments here is that it's a conflict of interest because I've got too many people to take care of. And so I can't do everybody justice. I can only do so many justice. And what you're saying, as I understand it, is you've got to give them kind of the deference to say at this point, you just have to take my word for it. At this point, I can't effectively continue to represent one other person.
Oh, you do not have to take their word for it, Your Honor. You should give substantial deference to it. You should consider how much experience they bring to it. You should consider particularly the data analysis that they went through to come to that conclusion. Nope. And that is subject to judicial review and a substantial deference standard.
And I appreciate that. What I'm getting to is this one of those cases where we have to decide whether this is a potential conflict of interest or is it an actual conflict of interest?
Your rule dovetails precisely with the analysis in Lucky versus Harris. Your rule says, our rule, binds me too. Your rule says if there is a significant risk that there's going to be a conflict, because you have too many clients to represent, then you may not take that representation. And that's exactly what Lucky versus Harris says.
And Lucky also addressed, and you all have disagreed on this, so I know you're over time, but I think it'd be helpful if you could address for us the Strickland standard applies when you're looking at overruling convictions. Your argument is that should not apply in a Sixth Amendment analysis, should apply when you're deciding whether or not up front, systemically, there's competent representation. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, that was the great Judge Vance who made that ruling in 1988 in the 11th Circuit. It was a wonderful victory for indigent defense, that prospective injunctive relief, which is not trying to upset the validity of any conviction, like the Strickland case.
Because it's dealing with the Sixth Amendment as opposed to the right to a fair trial, which is what Strickland's dealing with.
Precisely. The question is a substantial, serious, and unreasonable risk that effective representation will occur, you are entitled to prospective injunctive relief. You don't have to drive the car over the cliff. Okay? It's like any other case of injunctive relief. Unfortunately, as you know, or probably know, Judge Vance was assassinated, and subsequently, in 1992, the en banc court used the abstention doctrine, and we don't have that's Your Honor, that's why we're here today. That's why we're
What do you want us to decide today? If we were to decide in your favor, how would we change Pratt to do exactly what you want?
I want to be very clear about that, Your Honor. We are asking this court to prohibit trial courts from appointing a District 31 office or any other such office in similar situation to any more cases until the public defender office notifies the trial court that it is no longer on limited availability. And we ask this court to direct each judge in this state faced with this question to implement one of the Pratt options. One, announce that the court will not impose a jail or prison sentence upon conviction, in which case the case constitutionally may proceed without counsel. Two, appoint a private attorney. Three, not appoint anyone and wait until the public defender becomes available and able to accept the case. Or four, dismiss the case. In our view, all of these options are available. Different judges may choose different options as they deem appropriate for each individual case. However, this court must make clear to the trial courts in this state that in this situation, it is not an option to appoint the public defender, and the trial court must honor the public defender's notice of unavailability subject to a substantial deference standard.
Counsel,
so if the court,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If the court found that determination were arbitrary or unsupported by substantial evidence, it could then go ahead and appoint.
Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that the court has
just
no
just trying to be clear,
here.
Adding in what you talked about earlier.
Justice Breyer has a new book, Active Liberty. He talks about judicial modesty when there's substantial agency expertise, and you have that precisely here with a remarkable public defender organization with 150 years of collective experience in its management team.
Counsel, we have different situations in different counties in Missouri.
Oh, I know.
What opportunity is there to challenge the public defender's determination that they're unable to represent, as a matter of fact, county by county?
This question is going to arise in each district office, and the districts encompass various counties, as I understand it, Your Honor. And if the court agrees with us on the remedy, I think the court is going to have to.
Well, I'm talking to you about forum, really.
On
forum. Forum. Where does. I assume that you would agree with me that the ability of the public defender to take on more clients or their caseload is a question of fact.
I don't think there's any way to dispute that, Your Honor.
Okay, a question of fact. So, in each instance in which the allegation is made by the public defender that we can't represent these people, and in the situation where there are people that need to be represented, then that is a factual issue that might be explored.
That might be what, Your Honor?
Explored.
Explored?
Yeah, explored.
Again, subject to the substantial deference standard, I agree with that.
And it would be explored, I take it, at the county level or at the level of the public defender that's actually being, the question is being raised.
I don't see any way around that, Your Honor.
It's got to be there. So, I mean, my real concern is, I could understand this determination being made in a factual context with real facts, but here we're talking more about, it seems to me you're talking to us about a general rule.
Oh, well, what has been challenged here, it seems to me, is the protocol. And what we argue in this case with respect to the protocol is that protocol, which is databased with a Missouri experience, okay, is a protocol which is sufficiently reliable to inform the public defender's exercise of professional judgment Now, in each in District 31, when we went in on this case, we put on the development of the protocol, okay? And anybody that wanted to challenge that could challenge that there, okay? And I would hope that we would get a ruling from this court that that protocol is sufficiently reliable to inform the public defender's decision all over the state. Now it's going to have to be applied in various county circuit courts around the state. And it does not, this is very important, Your Honor, it does not operate automatically or exclusively. It is an important factor in the public defender's exercise of her professional judgment in that particular case. But I don't have any way around your question. There's going to be a factual inquiry at that point. I would hope we would not relitigate the reliability of the protocol. I think
I'm not sure the protocol has been fully litigated. I don't know whether it has or it hasn't. But in terms of your recommendations to us of what you are looking for,
yes, sir,
by way of relief,
yes,
then would you also include the opportunity in that, in each instance in which the public defender claims that they just cannot represent any more people, that there be the possibility, or there be a factual hearing to determine whether or not that's an appropriate determination in the situation of the defendant that's being put forward who needs representation?
I believe that's accurate, but what I'm hoping to get as a remedy in this case is to take the protocol and its reliability off the table, because I think that has been litigated in this case, and I think the evidence is overwhelming that it is sufficiently reliable, and particularly with the testimony of Dean Lefstein, who is the foremost expert in indigent defense in America. But the application of that protocol in each office, I cannot, wish I could tell you that there'd be no, I don't want, forgetting the number, but I don't want 115 challenges when the protocol is applied. I would assume that over time, people would come to realize that, A, the protocol is sufficiently reliable to be used.
Well,
in the way.
Here's what I'm getting at. You're talking to me in a statewide application.
Right.
You're talking to me about one determination made by the public defender as to a protocol.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a number of counties in Missouri. We have a number of defendants that are putting that will be put forward for representation, and that those are all factual determinations of when that can and cannot be done. And it seems to me you're asking for a unilateral ability to make the factual determination.
Oh, no, I would reject unilateral ability, and I think the American Bar Association rejects unilateral.
Okay, then explain to me the manner in which the challenge would be made that this is an inappropriate determination by the public defender.
Well, again,
that
I would hope...
they cannot go forward. Relative to the relief you want,
right?
How do we make the determination when there's a dispute over whether maybe they can represent some more people?
Right. I would hope that the reliability of the protocol would be taken off the table by these proceedings, and I would submit that we would go into District 42 or District whatever, and a public defender would say, I have exceeded the protocol, and I cannot go any further. I can't do it without violating the Constitution and without violating the Code of Professional Conduct, and I would assume that the state attorney would say, well, I don't think that's true. Okay.
So for all the other counties, we're supposed to assume that the protocol is valid?
Absolutely. I think you have enough evidence in this record to make that determination statewide.
But
how it gets applied, it is entitled the application of...
What you're saying is the various remedies, the four remedies that you're given, you'd still allow the circuit judge to look at his local situation as he sees it based on his experience, and fashion one of those four remedies, but accept the protocol.
As long as that local judge is instructed that you are to give substantial deference to the professional judgment of the public defender in making that review.
Can you respond to the special master's finding in his report that he questioned the accuracy of the protocol, and he said that he's questioning the sufficiency, whether or not the protocol is accurate to justify the imposition of the negative consequences on the rest of the criminal justice system.
The question, Your Honor. Here's what we got from the special master. It's not inaccurate. And it's appropriate in the sense that it goes a long way to relieve the public defender. We use that, we think a better way to summarize those words is reliability, because that's a term in statistical analysis and gives you a better opportunity for review. Now, the question is not the negative consequences to the rest of the system from the application of the protocol. The question is the protocol sufficiently reliable?
Accurate.
Mm-hmm. Accurate, appropriate, and we summarize those two into reliable for you because we think it's a more helpful term for you. Okay. You can disregard that if you want, but we think that helps your analysis. Okay. And is it sufficiently reliable to inform the exercise of professional judgment by the public defender? Now, I do want to say about this negative consequences for the rest of the system. This is essentially an adoption of the state's argument that the sky will fall if we obey the Constitution. Okay. What is remarkable, truly remarkable, about the special master's observation that the sky will fall if we observe the Constitution is that the sky already has fallen. We have lawyers performing, as the special master said, they put their licenses on the line every day. We have lawyers representing clients they can't competently, ethically, professionally, or constitutionally represent. If you read Mr. Sterling's affidavit, and it's a powerful and it's a graphic affidavit, it describes what is actually happening in very graphic terms. Because they can't represent everybody, they are pushing their resources. And they're pushing their resources to represent those accused of the most serious crimes. And in that process, Your Honor, and this is going to hurt, but I have to say it, they are throwing thousands of people under the bus. A lawyer can not do that. The sky has fallen. We are here today to lift the sky up. So I think the special master got it completely backwards. You know, it with all due respect. I'm way over my time, Your Honor. But
no, thank you for responding. I hope we will put our 150 years of experience to good effort in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I think the issue before the court today and the posture of this case is whether or not the Honorable John Waters followed the law. On July 28, 2010, Judge Waters had before him a defendant. Defendant Jared Blacktree was incarcerated. He was charged with several felony offenses, and he was asking the court for an attorney. Judge Waters did what the law requires him to do, is appoint him an attorney. Not only does Supreme Court Rule 31.02.
But does the judge have to take into consideration the ability of the attorney to effectively represent the defendant?
I don't think initially. That's not the first part of his duty. I think that's part of the equation, Your Honor. But initially, Judge Waters has the duty statutorily, also constitutionally under the United States Supreme Court in Asperger said, a trial judge has the duty to make sure that the Constitution is followed and that a defendant's constitutional right to an attorney.
An effective attorney. I mean, is there a constitutional right to an ineffective attorney? It's implicit in it, isn't it? And I mean, I assume you would recognize that if you appoint a knowingly incompetent attorney, you're not fulfilling their constitutional right.
Correct.
If you couldn't appoint a disbarred attorney, you couldn't appoint an attorney who was drunk or otherwise unable to represent them. So it's implicit they have to be competent. We're in a rock and a hard place here. How do you fulfill both those duties?
And I think that's, Your Honor, I agree. Trial judges have a duty to do both. However, there's been no evidence presented either before Judge Waters at the hearing nor at the hearing before the special master that any of the attorneys that were appointed to represent Jared Blacksher or any other particular defendant were ineffective or incompetent.
Well, if you look at the collective public defender entity, they're saying we can't do it. We cannot comply with our ethical duties to do it. And they say that loud and clear, as if an individual lawyer was in front of the judge.
I understand that that's what they're saying, Your Honor, but I think the rules that this court holds particular members of the bar to are individual rules. It's my individual responsibility as an attorney and as a member of this bar to come before this court or any other court and
well, we
say...
We said in one of the cases, in the Pratt case, which reminded me, we said you can appoint a public defender in their individual capacity.
Correct. And that particular...
Even though they're a member of the bar, you cannot appoint them in their individual capacity.
Correct. Because, again, this court was following what the law said. The law says that public defenders cannot have... any other cases outside the representation of defendants through the public defender
system. So why can't the Public Defender Commission is statutorily required to set rules for appointment of its attorneys, for representation of indigents and defendants, to manage its resources. And it's within its authority to, why isn't it not within its authority to set limits on what it finds its lawyers can competently do? I mean, if it found its attorneys were taking 2,000 cases a year, I think we could all agree no one could represent 2,000 felonies a year. Are we just talking about a question of did they set it at the right place? Are you saying that every attorney who had 2,000 felonies would nonetheless have to come before the judge and show on that individual basis why he couldn't do those 2,000 felonies? And isn't there some standard that we can apply, and don't you really have to in your duty as the commission, Public Defender Commission, supervising the public defenders and this court in supervising the way cases are tried to set some sort of why is it beyond our authority to set some sort of standard? Whether this is the right standard or not is a different question.
Well,
so, for instance, your point, if they just said we can't take more cases or we can't take certain kinds of cases, I mean, I understand your argument, but if in that individual, my understanding of this, and maybe I'm incorrect, so tell me your interpretation, that in that individual defender district, they looked for 3 months, they were 133% to 150% of what they determined was capacity repeatedly, and their understanding of our ethics rules, and tell me again if you disagree, is that you cannot take on representation, new representation, if you believe it will undercut or affect your representation of existing clients, because that creates a conflict between the existing clients and the new client, and that's the basis on which they're concerned they can't take on additional cases, because it will affect their ability to ethically represent their existing clients.
There's several parts to your question.
There are.
And I'll start with the first part. One, I do think the commission obviously has the ability to make rules for the proper implementation of the public defender system. I think the statutes clearly give them the authority to do that. I think clearly as supervisors, they have the ability to supervise their attorneys, to assign certain attorneys to certain cases, to allocate resources that are given to them in a certain way. And that's one issue. And then secondly, Judge Dole, you have a trial court that has a duty, a legal duty, a constitutional duty to make sure that this defendant who's in jail gets representation. Effective representation. And so part of your question is, how does the supervisor determine they're unethical or unethical? But again, Your Honor, I think some of that is to the individual's attorney's responsibility.
But you're saying basically they should have no rule. Every defender just has to go in. I mean, we've done that, and it's not worked effectively over the years. We are in the situation there where people are representing where they came in, and there's testimony in the record of people who are representing defendants because they're appointed to do it and they can't. Being effective in that.
I want to somewhat disagree, Your Honor, that the record does not show any attorney ever testifying in any proceeding that they felt like they were unethical in their representation of an attorney. The only evidence that was presented...
Doesn't the ABA brief or the Brian K. brief get into that to some extent?
But again, that's not evidence that was presented. That's what the brief says, but that's not the evidence that was presented.
Wasn't there evidence
the trial
that,
court?
For instance, I thought there was specific evidence, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that, for instance, when an expert's designated by the prosecution, they don't have the time to even research them on Google to check out their background, to check out their expertise. They don't do any kind of investigation in many of these cases because they simply don't have the resources, which is not what a competent and effective attorney would do. You need to find out if the expert evidence is valid.
Well, I mean, obviously I don't disagree that an attorney should investigate an expert that the opposing party wants to present. But again, there was no evidence in any particular cases or any particular person that says, hey, I can't represent this defendant.
So your solution is each attorney should come in each time, for instance, in one of those districts and say, I can't take on more. And so it's an individual determination for the judge and the attorney in each case. And what happens if the judge, because the judge is also in a very difficult position and needs to find someone to represent, this defendant, goes ahead and appoints them anyway. In your brief, it seemed to me you said you go look at the sort of back end and you make a Strickland determination after the person is convicted, if they're convicted. But opposing counsel says that's an entirely different issue than your Sixth Amendment right up front to have the effective assistance of counsel. That's a different question than what, and is judged by a different standard than whether or not you overturn a conviction at the back end.
I'm not sure I quite understand. I mean, I'm going to disagree with counsel. I don't think Lucky applies to this case, and the reasoning is Lucky was a different posture of case. Lucky was a civil rights violation that was brought by the attorneys in the public defender system in the state of Georgia against the state of Georgia, saying we have a problem. The posture that it got to the 11th Circuit wasn't trying to determine what the proper standard is. It got there because, one, the trial judge said, well, you can't sue the state of Georgia under the 11th Amendment. Two, even if you could, you failed to state a claim for which relief can be granted. And the court in Harris answered those questions saying, yes, the state of Georgia could be.
Can I come to a more practical response to this case? We have a dispute as to whether the public defender here can undertake more representation. What evidence was there about that in this record, and what procedure ought to work when these disputes arise? What are you arguing for?
Well, I guess rephrase the first part of your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, in this case, do right. we have evidence that would allow us to make a determination, or is the case mooted out because the individual pled? Well, and is there sufficient evidence that we can rule upon a practical approach to determining when there is sufficient representation available in the public defender's office?
First part of your question, Your Honor, obviously in our brief we said this case is moot because Jared Blackshear, who was the original person in this case, has ultimately, because this court allowed the writ to temporarily be stayed, when Mr. Blackshear has pled, was found guilty, and was sentenced before the Honorable Judge Orr. Therefore, I would agree on one point the case is moot because that's exactly, there is really no issue. There is no attorney representing Jared Blackshear anymore. His case is complete. The second part of your question, Judge, I don't think there's been enough evidence. I don't think that even in the trial court level or even before the special master, that the protocols that are promulgated by the public defender system have been thoroughly tested. I think Judge Sweeney pointed that out when he said, as Your Honor mentioned, that while they are not inaccurate, he didn't say they were accurate, he said they're not inaccurate, that there's serious question as to their accuracy when applied and how they will affect the entire judicial system.
So when and how does that question then get litigated?
Well, I mean, probably the better would be if there was a civil rights violation, as the court did in Lucky v. Harris, where you have a true adversarial proceeding, where one side can depose. We didn't have any depositions in this case. Judge Sweeney, the special master, didn't allow any cross-examination of any witnesses. So I think the way it does is a litigation where either a civil rights violation is alleged, where both sides have an opportunity to present experts, both sides have an opportunity to do depositions, to cross-examine each side's prospective experts and witnesses. I think in that sort of hearing is where we can ultimately flesh out whether or not the protocols as they currently stand are sufficiently accurate.
Isn't the practical problem then that when you have here we had a defendant, we had this issue arise, and the defendant ends up saying, look, you've got these huge statewide issues you all want to complain about, but I want to get on with my life and decide. How do we ever get to those huge statewide issues? In any case, you know, if we try it like a regular law case, the defendant is always the one that's bearing the brunt of both the public defenders and the prosecutor's battle for more resources. How do we flesh this out and know what to do?
I think obviously there's as the litigants did in Lucky, if you file a civil rights violation in federal court, you can fully flesh out the issues. I think, unfortunately, Judge, the way this current case sits before this court, they really haven't been fully fleshed out, and therein lies the problem. You know, we're wanting to set rules and do things that are going to affect the entire system, based on issues, based on protocols that haven't been fully fleshed out.
And so say we had a case, the kind of case you're talking about, like Lucky, or this case on remand, or if we were to find that they were fully fleshed out already in this case, then you agree that in that circumstance, which I know you think is not here, then the Public Defender Commission could set a protocol. But here you think they have not done adequate work to set it properly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think obviously they have the power to manage the attorneys that they have under them. That's one of the duties. The problem, like in this case, they said District 31 is overburdened. However, the statute says the public defender is the one that represents the indigent client.
Didn't they present proof that every public defender district was overburdened under the protocol?
I don't recall if they did, if that proof is there. If that proof is there, then it goes to the second thing. Statute allows 600.042 Section 5 allows the public defender to contract with private attorneys to meet their statutory obligation. There's been no evidence presented at any level that they had even attempted.
And of course, it's Wolf versus Ruddy.
Excuse me?
There's Wolf versus Ruddy.
Yes, sir.
Wolf versus Ruddy would apply, would indicate that judges can appoint private lawyers to as part of their professional obligation to represent criminal defendants.
I believe that this court did mandate in Wolf versus Ruddy that is an option that the trial court could have in front of it.
Of course, then we have the issues raised by the amicus brief on behalf of the criminal defense attorneys that today's complex world where some criminal cases are quite simple and straightforward, but others are very complex. Civil attorneys often are not competent to represent anyone, and so not competent to be appointed, and to put the entire burden on the private defense bar would overwhelm their resources. So how do we deal with that?
Well, again, I think that it sort of goes back. I mean, we sort of, unfortunately, in a catch-22, because if you start appointing private attorneys, we run into the same issue that the realtors say, well, are we going to be appointing ineffective counsel? If I'm primarily doing public personal injury law, and all of a sudden I get appointed to even a possession of controlled substance case, I may not be, while I may be a very good personal injury lawyer, I don't have the experience nor the knowledge to know, well, I need to find out, you know.
So the appointment of private lawyers is not an option?
Well, I think it could be an option if they were particularly. That's why
it's
I think
not
the
a complete
statute,
solution.
No, and I think that's why the legislature gave the public defender the ability to hire private counsel, so they know, hey, I'm hiring an attorney that's experienced in criminal law. I'm hiring an attorney that knows what they're doing. Therefore, they are getting qualified and competent counsel.
I'm asking Wolf versus Ruddy is outdated then. Really, someone who's doing personal injury cannot do a death penalty case. I mean, that's obvious.
Correct, Your Honor. I think Wolf versus Ruddy still has certain applications, particularly to this case, because in that case, this court did set out specific guidelines for a trial court to follow. Whereas in Pratt, those specific guidelines for the trial court to know, what am I supposed to do when a rule says, and the statute says, and the Constitution says I'm supposed to appoint an attorney?
I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked your opponent. The special master said that the protocol developed by the Public Defender Commission was not inaccurate, but there was serious question as to whether it was sufficiently accurate to justify the imposition of the negative consequences on the rest of the criminal justice system. I assume you're agreeing with that, but why? You know, what basis do you think that it may be not sufficiently accurate enough in light of the consequences that it could result?
Well, the consequences, especially at the hearing before the Special Master Judge Sweeney particularly asked Peter Sterling, well, if I buy into your logic, ultimately you're going to be refusing all cases. There's never going to be a time where you become available. And Peter Sterling and others said yes. So Judge Sweeney obviously knows there's negative consequences. And I think that's the problem. The protocols as they currently set were called into question by the National Center for State Courts, which Judge Sweeney and his power that this court gave him went out to an outside resource to look at it. I think before we use the protocols as they currently set to implement something that is going to affect the entire system, they need to be thoroughly.
Didn't their criticisms not disagree that they're too busy, but say it might be they could more efficiently use resources with paralegals and non-lawyer personnel and investigators, and you have to, and so forth.
I mean, diversion programs.
Diversion,
correct.
Right?
But again, it goes back to what Judge Sweeney says. Some of that's a systemic problem. Whether or not you have a diversion program, a program is going to determine whether you, in your particular circuit, you have a sufficient number of judges, you have sufficient amount of time to help and do diversion program, or you have commissioners. In our particular circuit, we have one circuit judge covering two, basically class one.
Of course, if you're in a diversion program and the prosecutor's taken an imprisonment off the table, at least at that point, then you don't need a public defender. So that wouldn't be in their caseload.
Well, you still have to have a obviously, as in Greene County, which is sort of the poster child for diversion programs, they have commissioners that, Commissioner Davis does a variety of diversion programs. Unfortunately, as our circuit, and I'm sure in a lot of circuits within the state, there's not sufficient judicial manpower for judges to do that. I mean, we have a drug court, and the Honorable Judge Orr's has a drug court in Taney County on top of his normal civil docket, on top of all his criminal dockets, on top of all his jury trials.
Well, the other thing is, it's the blind man and the elephant. You're specifically representing your county in the state of Missouri, and the systemic issue, as your able counsel indicated, even though he's not in Missouri right now, that I see every day in St. Louis City, there's people spending 2 years, or had been spending 2 years now, I think it's a year, in the city jail, waiting for a trial to be heard on things that aren't capital punishment. A year was 2 years at one point without having a trial, without any bond. And so, as you indicated, the cases get pushed back down, and only the most serious cases have been handled. But and maybe without enough resources. But you only see, as you should, what's in Christian County. Or what's in your county, so you're doing the best you can with what you got before you.
Yes, Your Honor. Do you want me to answer? I'm out of time. Do you want me to answer your?
No, go ahead. We gave the other side plenty of time.
If there's something further.
But no, I just want to make sure. Mm-hmm. Well, again, but what's the basic? But if you follow the public defender's protocols, you're basically going to run into a problem. What are you going to do with people like Jared Blackshear who are charged? Mm-hmm. And if this court says. And what the public defender wants you to do and say, well, we can make this rule, and therefore, because we make this rule, that rule should be binding on the trial court, and therefore the trial court can't appoint an attorney. Happens to the defendant?
Let me ask you a question about this specific case. If assume that the protocol says, you know, they're unlimited, they don't have the availability, so the public defender says, we just can't take any more cases, so you can't appoint me. Because there's a potential conflict of interest with all my other folks. Mr. Blackshear's sitting there. He wants a lawyer. He wants to plead guilty. And he may be entitled to probation or a short jail sentence. Lots of things would be a better result for him than being stuck in jail while the prosecutors and the public defenders fight about the systemic problem. So he's there. Well, in this particular case, at that point in time, there was no actual conflict because he had an offer on the table that he wanted to take. He just needed to help somebody to process it, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, that's exactly what happened. In fact, he was almost...
I understand this doesn't solve a systemic problem, but from a this case and the next case and the next case problem, as we look at it with courts, with real cases and real people, what about looking at the issue of whether or not there's an actual conflict of interest as opposed to a potential conflict of interest?
And I would agree with Your Honor. I think that's...
We have counties, the judiciary, we have to figure out a way to get our rural judges to cities and deal with caseloads. At the time that this was done, were they saying that there was no public defender anywhere in the state of Missouri that couldn't represent this person because of a potential or actual conflict?
No, I agree, and that was, again, never, I agree 100%, that's exactly what should be done, is that we need to look at this as what's the real conflict. And I think that's what one of the reasons Judge Sweeney made the statement that he did, is that we don't really have sufficient evidence, sufficient data to even say that, well, even in this particular case, the attorney that represented Mr. Blackshear, Morris Mettler, mm-hmm. never once, even at the time of plea or any other time, said, Your Honor, I can't represent Mr. Blackshear because I personally feel that I will be doing something unethical.
They did have evidence that of the 18 attorneys in the office, for the month of July. They had 35 pages, single-spaced, of actions or cases that needed to be handled. Isn't that pretty significant evidence? I mean, as opposed to the individual attorney getting up and saying, hey, I can't handle my caseloads, which most individual attorneys are going to be hesitant to do. Isn't the evidence that each attorney got over 20 cases a month that were assigned to them, and they had 35 pages of single-spaced assignments that they were required to take care of?
Your Honor, I would say that is not sufficient because that's not what they based their decision on. They weren't basing their decision really on the number of cases, because that's what the NAC standard was, is for the number of cases. You can see in the hearing before the special master that the public defenders sort of distanced themselves from the NAC standard.
They started with the NAC standards and then looked at the kinds of cases that they had. They did a workload study, just as the courts do for judges, to figure out how much time was spent on different types of felony cases versus misdemeanor cases versus post-conviction cases, assigned them all values, and also looked at the other kinds of overall issues you're saying should be looked at in deciding what's a reasonable, whether they're over the protocol limits and what are ways to solve it. You're saying they need to have more, you're saying they shouldn't rely on these numbers, and you're also saying they improperly didn't rely on those numbers.
Well, that's
I mean,
not what
they used
they
those
said.
Numbers and plus other things and divided out the numbers among complexity of cases. What should they have done instead, you're saying?
What they should have done instead, and again, is just they're wanting to do something that's going to impact the entire system. They needed to, and I think Peter Sterling admitted in the second affidavit in response to Judge Sweeney's findings that they really didn't do a sufficient workload study because, as he said, they didn't have the sufficient resources nor time to do that. So I think
I don't believe he said it was insufficient. There's always, I think there's, well, go ahead.
And so I think it'd be nice that they, you know, we have some people to look at, do that. I mean, Peter Sterling's obviously a very competent attorney, but there's been no evidence that he's a statistician or even statisticians were used, or people that deal with, have expertise in the area of time studies and time management and how you calculate that. I think they did the best they could with the resources they had. However, we're wanting to change something that's going to affect the child's entire judicial system. They're asking that the public defender system be allowed to dictate to the local trial court
that would give certain, if we were to give deference as indicated to the protocol and say they can't take the cases, then everything would be clear. The defendant has to, the judge has to find another way of getting this defendant an attorney. And that's it'd be clear and certain. We wouldn't end up with, we've had, I guess, five or six of these kind of cases come up to us with signing the defender, and that way it would then, the protocol would be set, and then the judge would have to look at these other three or four options they would have before them to get the person an attorney.
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, I think if you do give deference to the public defender, then we're going to be right back here with the Wolf versus Rudy issue where a trial judge goes, well, counsel, you're sitting there.
But Wolf versus Rudy might be obsolete at this point.
Well,
it might be a different situation, but we need to resolve it in some way to give some certainty to all parties.
I understand your concern and saying we can't just shift the problems from one part of the system to another part, but does that mean, I mean, in effect, what you're saying, though, or opposing counsel would say what you're saying, is that that means we should turn a blind eye to violating the Constitution by appointing counsel who say they cannot competently represent one more person because they have too many already, and certainly a court has no desire, nor would a court intentionally appoint someone who they knew would be incompetent or ineffective. And they certainly don't want to do that, and yet, in effect, you're saying, but we're not sure what the ramifications would be for the rest of the system, so we better just keep doing that because we don't have an overall great solution. But can we do that constitutionally and just ignore these constitutional implications, even though I completely agree with all the concerns you raise about what will this then happen down the line?
Well, because I disagree with the counsels that this is what they're saying is actually has constitutional application. This court has said, and the trial courts have a primary duty to see that the criminal justice system moves forward. The trial judge has a constitutional duty to make sure that defendants get attorneys. that the system goes forward so that the, I think as this court has said previously, that so that the guilty are convicted and the innocent are acquitted. If we buy into the system or we say that they have some constitutional issue here, well, how do you deal with the court's primary duty to make sure that the system runs smoothly?
So that in some ways there's a separation of powers in that we're the judiciary. The public defender is part of the executive branch. It is part of the administration of the state's duty to provide, as per Gideon versus Wainwright, a Missouri case, their duty to provide services to the indigent defense. But how much can we review an executive branch duty? The public defender is appointed by the governor. The public defender commission is appointed by the governor. It's part of the state of Missouri. It's not part of the judiciary.
Correct. But they're asking you to then give them, the executive branch, power over the judicial branch. The public defender is wanting you to say, well...
No, they're just saying we don't want to get appointed.
Right.
They're not saying we're not power over the judicial branch.
Well,
they're just saying we don't want to get appointed.
The court can't appoint incompetent counsel, and they're saying we have authority to say what we can competently handle. They're not trying to tell the judge what to do. They're simply saying we can't competently do this, and a court wouldn't knowingly adopt a rule that require them to appoint incompetent counsel.
As the executive branch, they're issuing regulations according to the legislative. It's another branch, a legislative framework for whether it's a legislative framework for dealing with the public defender. So it's the legislative branch and the executive branch. It's not the judiciary branch. The judiciary branch is trying to find lawyers for the defense, but they can say we're not, we can't ethically give effective counsel to these defendants.
Well, I agree that there are separation of powers, and then again, that was brought up in the hearing before the special masters that they tried to get the rules adopted by the Missouri legislature, and it was vetoed by Governor Nixon. I think that speaks volumes that the legislature process didn't work. They tried it, and unfortunately, the legislature process says no, these rules cannot be enforced because Governor Nixon.
Well, I don't think that's the legislative history. They were trying whatever they were doing. We don't have legislative history in the state with the federal government. They were trying some way of resolving a very difficult situation, and as it turned out, as the process worked between the legislative and the executive branch, that option didn't work. So they're back to the option they're dealing with now, which we're trying to work with.
But again, their option is, again, imposing upon the judiciary a burden that now the judge has to say, well, I have a constitutional right or constitutional responsibility as a judge. I have a Supreme Court responsibility. The law mandates
but that. But this doesn't diminish the judge's responsibility. One element of that of solving the judge's problem of getting counsel for the defendant is not available. So the judge has to figure out another way of getting counsel for the competent counsel for the defendant.
And I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor. I think it does diminish the court's capacity because the judge has an obligation, obviously, to follow the law. The law says I shall appoint an attorney. The law says that I shall appoint the public defender, not a particular district or particular office, but the particular defender. So if we follow their reasoning, they are, in fact, diminishing the authority of the trial court because now he says, well, I can't follow the law because the law says I have to appoint them. I've got to do something different and not follow the law.
Any other questions? Thank you for your patience for our questions. I wanted you to have a fair time to answer our inquiries. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Price, I want to go back and address the question that you asked Mr. Dobbs and that you questioned me about when I was up here. And this is a very important question in terms of the administration of justice in this state as a practical matter. And I think that's where your questions were heading. And the question you asked Mr. Dobbs was what procedure ought to apply when these disputes arise. Now, I have a really smart client, Your Honor, and she's sent me a note here. And she's not afraid to speak up. And I need to modify my response to your questions with respect to the focus of that hearing down in front of the trial court the next time this thing comes up. We feel strongly, Your Honor, that we do not need a county-by-county determination because the protocol takes into account local conditions like the number of public defenders in the county, the number of cases, the kinds of cases, the tasks in those categories of cases that need to be done. And that this court should determine here, in this case, that this protocol is sufficiently reliable to inform the public defender's judgment across this state, taking into consideration those local facts. The rule requires us to provide data in each court and each county supporting unavailability. And so the focus, as we see it, of that inquiry is simply, it occurs now that it's hopefully going to occur in each county court hereafter, is simply our compliance with our rule. Did we or did we not comply with that rule?
Because in your protocol, does your protocol take into account the severity of the crime?
The protocol takes into account the severity of the crime because
in terms of who will be represented and who will not, is there a triage mechanism in your rule? Or do you balance off representing the minimal crimes against those that are most major and of most concern to the local communities?
No, the protocol does not assume triage and movement.
Then how can that be a practical rule for the allocation of scarce resources in our counties when you don't take into account the need of the county to prosecute the most severe crimes? That is a much more important need than to prosecute some of the less severe crimes, the misdemeanors, the other things.
I would anticipate, Your Honor, that decision is going to be made by the trial judge when he gets to the point and he says, this is the application of their protocol.
And
this is how many homicide cases they've done. This is how many
But we're going to have a situation in Missouri. Mm-hmm. We have a situation where there aren't enough resources to go around for everyone's needs. The prosecutors don't believe they're funded enough. The courts don't believe they're funded enough. Public defenders don't believe they're funded enough. It's going to require that we all focus on what is the most pressing needs of government and do those things and let some other things go. Your protocol doesn't have that kind of a mechanism in place, does it?
I believe it does.
Oh, does it? Would you explain that to me then?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the protocol is based upon a whole series of categories of crimes and a whole series of tasks within those categories that have to be accomplished in order to provide effective and competent representation of counsel.
In response to Judge Price's question, isn't that what Pratt prohibited the public defender from doing?
Yeah, the public defender can't do that. It's the court that's going to wind up doing this, Your Honor, and the court is going to say, all right, we don't have, it seems to me that it's going to be the court, and the court is going to say, well, we can't use the public defender for about 27% of the cases. That's what they're about 27% overload.
Like, how did that work in this case? Would you tell me how that proceeding worked in this case?
Well, what you all said in Pratt was that in certain cases, no public defender would be appointed. Okay? This assumes you've exhausted every other possibility, and you're sitting there, and a public defender says, I can't take any more of these cases. I would assume that the trial courts will say, well...
No, but how did that happen in this case? How did that happen in this case? What's our factual record to make the determination?
How was the determination made that they were over the limit of the protocol, which does distinguish in a weighted workload between felonies and misdemeanors, between sex crimes and regular felonies, between post-conviction, so it does, in fact, weight crimes by the amount of time they take.
It does.
And therefore
they're
I know the protocol weights them, but how is the determination made that this person gets a lawyer and the next person doesn't?
Right.
That's what we're after.
I think you all have said clearly in Pratt that determination is not going to be made by the public defender. We're clear on that, right?
I'm not sure I'm clear on anything, to tell you the truth. I mean, I really don't think we've... I'm not sure there's very much that's clear about any of this.
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that in that situation, the trial judge is going to get together with the prosecutor and say which of these crimes have the highest risk and the lowest risk, and we're going to assign...
In each county, there'll be a factual determination with the prosecutor and the defender about triage of who gets represented and who doesn't.
That's what I understand, Your Honor.
And what about like in this case then? We've got a defendant that nobody wants to represent, that wants to plead guilty and get his case over with, and we're trying to fix a systemic problem, and the individual problem we've created is there somebody in jail who could otherwise have his case resolved?
I think that the Pratt case recognizes this. That's the inevitable result of how you tee this issue up. Yeah. A writ of prohibition issues. The court issues an order. The court says take no further action in this case, pending further order of the court. And then the prosecutor came in and said, would you modify? The court said, we'll modify, and we represented him.
And
Your Honor, I don't want to underestimate or undervalue that man's right there, but we can't postpone this decision. It would never end.
Right.
Okay,
so we can never get the case. I
understand. Let me ask it because that really gets to the bottom line here, which everybody I think is focused on. We're just looking for some guidance. Your thought is that there's these four things. If you assume they can make these decisions, then your thought is whenever they reach limited availability, the only remaining remedies at that point, according to you, are to announce no jail time, appoint private counsel, no appointment until available, which at some point in time means there's going to be a speedy trial issue and somebody who's accused is going to be released because the courts will not tolerate that sort of constitutional violation as indicated by the fact that it happens here, or that the case will be dismissed. Okay, and then I understand the argument, and I understand the basis. If we're really to that sort of crisis here, and I'm not saying we're not. If we're really there, then is a potential better remedy to look at these claims of ineffective assistance once there's a real case to determine if there was a real actual conflict of interest and real actual ineffective assistance occurred? Which isn't in this case because the guy pled guilty and his case is over.
And the answer to that is that the ethical rule says if there's a significant risk of ineffectiveness, you may not go forward, and it dovetails perfectly with the Lucky holding. Mm-hmm. I would suggest, Your Honor, that the trial court in Springfield, in this case, might have started with a case that's in the record in terms of cases we're not going to impose prison time. We had man with no prior criminal record, as I understand it, who was accused of fishing with illegal bait. And we couldn't get prison off the table on that case. And Judge Price, I know you've been over to the legislature and talked to them about this. And I know, Judge Stith, you've been over there. And I know Judge Wolf was over there. And I'm confident that Chief Justice Tidelman is going to go over there. There are just a ton of criminal acts where we're not scared of these people. We're angry at them. And we got to learn to differentiate between
who we're scared. The legislature did change some of the laws recently. They did change.
And you've got the Pew Charitable Trust in here right now helping you with this.
The question, when Judge Fisher ran through that list, that wasn't a list that you came up with as to what the options for the trial court was. You were citing what this court came up with in the Pratt case.
I might have restated it a little bit,
But those were the question I have to you is, can this court recognize that the trial judge has much greater authority than that? That those aren't the only options because of the trial court or this court's rights to manage its dockets and the inherent right, and what we had focused on in Pratt was the authority that was given to the public defender by the legislature,
right.
And so does this court have greater options to manage the problem, such as Judge Price pointed out, to look at the severity of the cases And when it says we have to appoint a private attorney, that some choice is made as to what type of case you appoint the private attorney on.
The people of this state have given this court the power of superintending control. Not every Supreme Court has that in this country. And I think that's a huge responsibility and a huge opportunity here. And I don't want my imagination to be the limit of yours. If you have better ideas on how to do this, but you cannot appoint a public defender in that situation. And if the trial court, can triage those cases, that seems to me to be potentially the best remedy you have. And you have a whole bunch of candidates, starting with fishing with illegal bait.
Counselor, when you say can't appoint the public defender, what about the remedy that's somewhat suggested that by appointing the public defender, maybe not somebody who's in an area that's been certified with limited availability, does the trial judge have the authority to say this person's indigent, they're entitled to effective representation, I appoint the public defender's office to represent this person? Now, I'm not trying to micromanage you. I don't know who's too busy and who's not, but you have to find somebody on your staff because the law says I have to appoint the public defender. And then the public defender has to look, and if he has to go out of county, like sometimes we have to go out of county to get judges to send them to places, that would allow the public defender then to make those decisions to satisfy their obligation. And I'm not saying that that's a perfect response, but I want to hear your response to it.
My response is that that's going to create another hearing, another controversy, and just going to bring the justice system to a halt.
It doesn't create another hearing if the trial judge says, the law requires me to appoint the public defender, I appoint the public defender, and I don't pretend to know who would have an actual conflict or potential conflict in your office, and you've got to find somebody because this person deserves a lawyer and the Constitution requires.
Your Honor, that's just not going to work. We have 8 right now who have a certificate of limited availability. We got 22 who are ready for it, and we put it on hold. That leaves us 4 places around the state, and this is just going to be so circular it will never end, and the court doesn't want to do that, I don't think. Okay. I don't want to. Well, again, I go back to it. I don't want to limit your imagination with mine. If you've got a better way, fine. But the public defender can't be appointed, and perhaps judicial triages.
One last point. That we have our new judge, Judge Draper, who has more criminal experience than a whole bunch of us together. Now, he may decline, but Judge, do you want to ask a question or two?
I have no questions. Thank you, though.
All right. Thank you, and I appreciate the time. Go ahead.